You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, it's fall migration season in Wisconsin, and we'll find out which birds are passing through the skies overhead.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. This week, we've got a sneak peek at some of the possible cuts that could make their way into Governor Scott Walker's state budget next year.
There's also continued fallout from last week's major investigative report from the Guardian newspaper, which published 1,500 pages of leaked court documents from the John Doe investigation in Wisconsin.
And the city of Milwaukee landed a big grant this week aimed at addressing trauma after civil unrest. Robert Mentzer joins us each week at this time to round up some of the top state news stories. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. Rob, thanks as always.
Hey, thanks.
Rob, state agencies submitted their budget proposals this year with a twist. There's this new state law that requires them to say, okay, give us what you want, what would stay the same, I guess, and just for the heck of it, show us what it would be like with a 5% cut.
Sure.
So talk about this new law and what we saw here.
Yeah, it's a strange thing. Somehow the focus goes straight to those cuts, huh? Yeah. So this is what the new law requires, and these came in from the departments this week. They range, right? There would be cuts of $4.6 million to the Department of Public Instruction, which do include some that would come out of schools. The Department of Justice put forward a proposal that would eliminate 27 state prosecutor positions. That's worth $2.4 million. The Department of Transportation had a bunch of proposals, as you would expect, less money for road maintenance. They would reduce the amount of salt the department buys for roads in winter. And something that I personally might not have thought of, they would eliminate the requirement that cars have a front license plate. Maybe that would fix the budget situation. Who knows?
Yeah, and so this new law, what was the thinking there behind saying, don't just give us the budget you want, give us this, what it might look like with cuts?
Well, so, I mean, I think of it, there is some defense to this, right? If these departments need to be looking for efficiencies and improving their systems, then there could be an incentive for them to, if they have to put forward a budget that includes 5% cuts, that they might have to think creatively about how they organize their budgets. On the other hand, as has been pointed out by some critics at the time that law passed, and now that these budgets are actually forward, in some ways the incentive from the departments is to make it look like if they had to cut 5%, it would be the end of the world, right? So there's some question about how much in good faith some of the budget proposals were put forward. Like, how does it sound politically to cut 27 prosecutors?
Right. Some lawmakers, especially Republican lawmakers, are saying, hey, you're not doing this right. You're trying to lay down a worst case scare tactic, in effect.
Right, exactly. And another example of this is the way that, it's just everything's sort of interconnected, so it's not simple. There, cuts at the state level very often can increase pressure at the local level. So you see this in the way that we've seen a huge number of school referendums happening across the state. And you see this in one of the proposals put forward from the Department of Corrections that would require counties to pay almost half the cost of probation and parole programs. So that would, quote unquote, save the state $54.7 million to the Department of Corrections, but it doesn't really save, it doesn't really reduce the tax burden. It just goes to the county level.
And this, I was going to say, Rob, this, of course, is an early stage here. This is a proposal. The governor doesn't have to put it in his budget proposal. The legislature doesn't have to agree with his budget proposal. There's a lot of steps yet to go here.
Right. Exactly right. Exactly right. It's very hard to know that whether any of this will become policy, but I guess it's sort of an opening. It's part of the continuing process of gearing up as state government gears up for the big budget process.
Talking to Rob Mentzer from USA Today Network Wisconsin, looking at some of the big stories around the state this week. Milwaukee's Office of Violence Prevention got some good news, a big grant aimed at addressing trauma and promoting resiliency in high-risk youth and families. What kind of things are we hearing that this grant might do in Milwaukee?
Sure. So $5 million for a five-year grant. This federal grant is designed for communities that have experienced civil unrest, and Milwaukee has. So it's going to go to largely community partners, grassroots organizations that work with youth, work with families. One of the programs is one that provides jobs for young people ages 16 to 24. Another big thing that the grant will be used for is to train after-school program providers on what is called trauma-informed care, which is basically a way of trying to connect with and help young people who have mental illnesses or have, you know, suffer post-traumatic stress or other types of stressors that affect child welfare.
This is an issue we're going to cover more on the show, I think, but the idea here isn't, here's a $5 billion grant, invent a whole bunch of new programs. It's to support a lot of stuff that is either happening or in the works already. Do I have that right from what you're saying?
That's exactly right. I mean, and it's largely the design of it is to pass through the Office of Violence Prevention in Milwaukee to these grassroots programs that are already in existence, and they already work with a number of these programs. So the hope is that they can these existing organizations can expand their programming and reach more kids or add more tutors or whatever it may be.
And let's move on to last week's big story, which is still echoing this week, that dump of documents by The Guardian magazine on the John Doe investigation, looking into Governor Scott Walker's campaign and outside groups like the Wisconsin Club for Growth. And now that group, they're the target of complaints being taken to the IRS. What's going on there?
Yeah, big story, right? So it's still going this week. In essence, one of the key things that were shown in those documents is that Governor Scott Walker was doing direct fundraising for the Wisconsin Club for Growth. There were emails showing talking points on how to get these rich conservative donors to write big checks to the Club for Growth. There were emails where Walker was boasting about that he had scored big donations for this organization. So, there's no debate at this point that this was what was happening. So, did it violate the law? Maybe. This week, the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, the nonprofit watchdog group, filed this complaint saying that the Club for Growth had provided a private benefit for Walker's campaign and for the Wisconsin Republican Party. And what this comes down to is that the Club for Growth is a tax-exempt nonprofit. So the deal that they have, the deal the government makes with a nonprofit is you can be exempt from paying these taxes as long as you promote an issue and not a political party, not a particular candidate. So if they put out an ad that says taxes are bad, that's an issue. But if they're operating as the arm of a campaign, then, you know, that's not legal.
There had been complaints in recent years that the IRS had given too much scrutiny to conservative tax-exempt groups, and there's still action in Congress on that, trying to impeach IRS officials. Is the IRS expected, when experts look at this, to take this up and run with it?
Yeah, very hard to say, but I would think that due to those controversies in 2013, that it would be difficult for the IRS to do that. It also is, to be fair, it also is quite squishy. What is the boundary between between an issue and a politician, right? If the Club for Growth is, organized around reducing tax rates, this is like a major plank of Republican politicians. It is legitimately hard to referee the exact point at which an issue ad becomes partisan activity. Most people would say that, who are you kidding? Like, at some point, the Club for Growth is well aware of what it's up to here, and that's probably true. But as a strictly legal matter, I don't think anybody quite knows yet.
And the Wisconsin Supreme Court has ruled on this, completely shut down the investigation. It's all completely done, asterisk, unless the U.S. Supreme Court decides to pick it up. And they're expected to review the case, I understand, on Monday.
Is that soon? Oh, man. This is the story that keeps on rolling.
Yeah, so, I know you don't have mind-reading ability for U.S. Supreme Court justices, as far as I know, but any over-unders on how likely it is they're going to take that up?
I'm going to do? I'm going to dial up my eight closest Supreme Court justice friends, and I'll report back. Let's say maybe like Tuesday.
All right. Well, let's move on to one quick bonus question here, Rob. The MacArthur Foundation, they give out this, they call it the Genius Grant. They don't. Everybody else does. And somebody in Milwaukee got one among the 23 winners. A lot of money, a lot of prestige here. Tell us about her.
Yeah, theater artist Anne Basting is a genius. She is a she's at the University of Milwaukee, and she is officially a genius, according to the way that everyone except the MacArthur Foundation refers to the award, for working in theaters in theater on responding to the challenges of aging and dementia with creative engagement. What she does is hosts improv storytelling and poetry nights for older folks, people who are suffering from dementia, and runs a nonprofit called Time Slips that makes these the methods available and trains nurses and folks in nursing homes all over the state to work on this. So that's cool. She's a genius.
And we have talked to her on Central Time and elsewhere on the Ideas Network. If you want to hear more about Anne Basting, go to WPR.org and search our archives for Basting, B-A-S-T-I-N-G. Rob, thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thanks a lot.
That's Robert Mentzer, storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin, based in Wausau. He joins us every Friday to round up the top state news stories of the week.
You might have seen a lot of different birds in your backyard over the last couple of weeks. We are now at the peak of bird migration in Wisconsin, and we have an expert to help us identify some of the birds passing through the state on their way south.
Ryan Brady joins us now. He's a research scientist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and bird monitoring coordinator for the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative. Ryan, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Well, who is showing up these days, Ryan?
Well, there's a lot of birds out there right now. It's a great time of year. There's a tremendous diversity of lots of different species. Most of our neotropical migrants, and those are migrant birds that spend their summers up in Canada or in Wisconsin and then spend their winters down in the tropics like Central and South America, those are just about on their way out now. So things like the warblers, some of the thrushes, the hummingbirds, those orioles and grosbeaks that we love in our backyards, the flycatchers, those are just kind of passing through now and headed out of here because they're dependent on insects, and those are going to get hard to find here once the frost hits. And we're starting to see more of those shorter distance migrants, so the ones that don't go quite as far, maybe only winter down in the southern U.S., things like sparrows and juncos and kinglets and northern flickers and cedar waxwings, American robins, some of the blackbirds. We've got a lot of raptors moving through right now, so keep your eye to the sky for things like broadwing hawks, sharp-shinned hawks, even some merlins and peregrine falcons. Our shorebird numbers are on the decline. They peak in the month of August, but there's still a few hanging on. And then lastly, the waterfowl migration, which a lot of folks love, that really kicks up in October. So we're just starting to see the vanguard of the geese and some of the ducks like the teal and the divers like scaup and redheads and things like that.
So, Ryan, how would you compare spring migration to fall migration?
Well, the spring migration tends to happen really fast. Birds are in a big hurry to get back up to the breeding grounds. They generally migrate north on those warm south wind days that we all love in spring. The reverse is kind of opposite in the fall. It's a little bit slower passage for most of the species. The species composition is kind of the same. The fall can be a little trickier because the birds aren't singing. Many of them are in an appearance or a plumage that isn't as brightly and boldly colored, so they can be harder to tell exactly what they are, even for some of the most avid bird watchers. But I really enjoy the challenge of that during the fall months, and it's really just a wonderful time of year to be out there looking at birds.
Yeah, for you and other people who are birders, for that matter, what are some of the most exciting birds from the ones you just mentioned? What would be a great one to be able to check off?
Well, as a group, I think a lot of folks are really in love with the warblers. So there's about 30, 35 species of warblers. They're small, they're colorful. In the spring, they really have these wonderful songs. They're just such interesting birds. And so even in the fall, a lot of folks are really passionate about those. A lot of folks love the big hawks, right? So things like eagles and red-tailed hawks, these powerful flyers soaring way up high in the sky. But actually, you know, right now there's an event going on up in Superior, Wisconsin, that's sponsored by the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. It's called Jaegerfest. And it's named Jaegerfest because folks are up there looking for a special kind of bird called a Jaeger. And that is a, kind of think of it as a cross between a gull and a falcon. And so they're out there looking for parasitic Jaeger, Pomeranian Jaeger, and maybe even a long-tailed Jaeger, as well as some other birds that typically you only find on big expanses of open water, often the ocean, but in this case Lake Superior, and that's things like Sabin's gulls and Arctic terns and some other rarities. So there's about 100-plus birders up there right now sitting on Wisconsin Point scanning the waters of Lake Superior looking for one of these birds.
Parasitic Jaeger, what's it, how did it get that name, or does it just have bad PR people?
It gets that name because it steals food from other birds, so it literally chases gulls around and makes them regurgitate the food that they've eaten and then steals it.
Okay, it deserves a bad name.
It probably does.
We're talking with Ryan Brady right now. He's a research scientist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and bird monitoring coordinator for the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative. We're talking about the fall bird migration. And Ryan, I'm guessing that this is a sound that a lot of people might be hearing right about now. So that's a bunch of Canada geese. And I have to say, sometimes people get confused because they see a flock of geese flying and they say, but wait, they're not flying south. They're going in the wrong direction. What's going on if we see them heading in a slightly different trajectory?
Well, if they're going in a different direction, they're probably not actively trying to migrate south. They might just be moving to a food source. So they'll often roost in one place and then fly out to feed in others. And anyone who hunts geese knows this quite well. We're just at the beginning of the goose migration now. Usually around the second week of September, we start seeing birds coming in from Canada. And that's happened through the month, but it'll really build through October, and then it even peaks later on into early November. And depending on what kind of winter we have, if it's a late winter, we'll get a lot of birds sticking around well into December. So it's interesting to look for some other species among them. There's a smaller version called the cackling goose. Occasionally you'll see a snow goose or a greater white-fronted goose in with them, so check your geese flocks carefully.
I'm not a great birder, but I can identify, you know, geese in general. And here's the sound of another bird I can actually pick out of a lineup. And that's me imitating the sound, by the way. I'm getting pretty good. Oh, no. Judith collected these earlier. The sandhill crane, I gather, is that sound. I love that sound, and I love when I can actually spot one of those. Right? Are they moving through now, or have we missed them already?
Well, it's a little early, actually. They're just starting the stage. You'll see groups of them. Some of them may be moving already, but you're going to start seeing numbers gather. You'll see concentrations of them. The numbers will get a little higher out in those ag fields and wetlands. And then really later on in October and the first part of November as well is when the numbers tend to be at their peak. And then they'll take off and head south. Most of ours go to Florida, and so that's where they'll spend their winter before they head back in late February or March.
So there's another kind of migration that we see, and it's hard to believe, but for some birds, Wisconsin is actually the warmer, more hospitable place. A few years, we've had these great eruptions of snowy owls coming down from the Arctic. Is there any way to predict if this is going to be a good year for snowies?
There is no way to predict, and to be honest, snowy owls have been making scientists scratch their heads for the last few years because they're doing things no one expected them to do with so many consecutive years of being out here in high numbers. So we don't really know what's going to go on with snowy owls just because they're in a very remote area right now of northern Canada. There's not a lot of folks up there monitoring prey sources like lemmings and other rodents, and they tend to be rather nomadic, so it's kind of tough. But it's interesting you bring that up because there is another group of bird called the winter finches. So things like crossbills and red poles and evening grosbeaks and these ones we get in the wintertime that a lot of folks are interested in. And there is a forecast for those that just came out today, actually, from some Canadian ornithologists. And that's based on seed crops that are observed throughout the boreal forest as well as the fruit crops. And right now it looks like we're not in for a big year in Wisconsin for many of the winter finches. But we'll have to wait and see because it's just a forecast. And that's kind of the fun part. You never know what each season's going to bring.
Ryan, what can we do if we want to lure some of these migrating birds into our backyards? Any good advice?
Well, it's all about food, water, and shelter. And so when I say food, I don't just mean bird feeders. I also mean planting native plants, so things that will harbor insects, which a lot of our migrant birds eat and need, as well as fruits, so things like the dogwoods, cherries, mulberry, elderberry, blackberries, those sorts of things can really, really be useful. In terms of water, A simple bird bath works. If you can get a trickling sound, that will help to attract the birds. That's very useful. Or if you have the ability, something bigger like a stream or a backyard pond can be very, very helpful. And then shelter, dense conifers, evergreens, even dense deciduous cover, things that will provide refuge from predators or from wind and snow eventually in the wintertime. And brush piles are really good. We have a tendency to want really clean lawns, clean understory. We pick up our brush, we rake all those leaves, and we go and we get rid of them. But that's all really good habitat. So if you can take some of that and we'll either leave it or lump it all together into these nice brush piles, that's excellent cover and will bring more birds to your yard.
Well, my very lackluster gardening is actually clearly for a reason. Now, at least I have an excuse. But, Ryan, I have seen in some kind of birding discussions online and stuff that people worry that if they make it too nice and too hospitable, that somehow we're going to convince birds to not continue their migration, that they'll say, you know, this backyard in Madison is exactly where I want to be. Is there any real risk of that?
No, there is no real risk of that. The birds have been migrating for many, 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 many years. They need high-quality food sources to get to where they want to go. Your high-quality habitat will not make them want to stay, but it will provide them the nourishment, the cover, and the things they need during the migration, which is an extremely taxing time during their lifetime. To make it through a migration to the wintering grounds with all the obstacles in the way, communication towers, all the building windows, predators that are out there, outdoor cats, all these things that kill birds, you providing excellent habitat is by far the best thing that you could do for them.
Briefly, Ryan, if we want to migrate around the state this weekend to spot some of these, can you give us a couple good hot spots?
Well, Wisconsin Point in Superior, like I mentioned, would be a great place to run up to. The folks will be there through the weekend if you have the time. You can almost never go wrong with Horicon National Wildlife Refuge. Crex Meadows up in the northwest corner of the state is fabulous. Bay Beach Sanctuary over in Green Bay is fantastic. And any of the kind of city parks and other natural areas along the Lake Michigan shoreline. Shorelines are very good places to find birds during migration as they tend to get concentrated there.
Well, Ryan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Ryan Brady is a research scientist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and bird monitoring coordinator for the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative, and we've been talking about the fall bird migration.
I'm stuck on the idea of this parasitic Jaeger making, was it gulls?
Yeah, making them throw up.
And eating their food. Yeah. Why has no professional sports team or college sports team taken the parasitic Jaeger as its mascot?
Yeah, because what is it? UC Santa Clara? Santa Cruz
banana
has the banana
slugs.
Yeah, and I want to know, is this on the ground or is this in flight? Because that would be really, really impressive.
Go Jaegers. This is Central Time. Earlier this month, WPR News reporter Bridget Bowden joined us to tell us about a new series she's working on. Bridget is spending the next few months embedded with the newest class of recruits at the Madison Police Training Academy. In her most recent installment for that series, she followed the newest class on their first day at the academy and through some of their physical fitness tests. Here's her report.
It's a few minutes before 8 a.m. on the first day of the Madison Police Department Training Academy. 23 new recruits are sitting at desks dressed in suits and ties. They're greeted by Lieutenant Marianne Flynn Stotts, who runs the academy day to day. She welcomes them and then gets serious.
As you know, you're coming into a profession that is under fire like it never has been at any other time. And here at Madison, we're incredibly proud of how we train.
It's a big day for the recruits, so it's clear they're nervous. After a short orientation, they take an oath in front of the mayor, their families, other officers, community leaders, and the chief of police.
And the charter of the city of Madison.
And the charter of the city of Madison.
On day two, that nervousness has mostly gone away.
You got it?
The recruits take a fitness test that includes a mile and a half run, a sprint, push-ups, sit-ups, a vertical jump, and an agility run.
Nice, yeah.
Nice.
The class is nearly 70% white, which is slightly less than Madison as a whole. Of the 23 recruits, 10 are female. Julie Clayton moved from Milwaukee to take the job. She says her family was surprised when she told them she wanted to become a cop.
They thought I was going to go into music. I played flute for a long while, and so that's how most of my friends and family knew me. And that's what I originally went to school for.
Now she's finishing up a degree in criminal justice. She says she wants to be an officer because she wants people to see the police as allies.
Because I had a lot of positive experiences, thankfully. And so I know of friends and others that haven't had positive experiences, and it makes me sad to think about that. And people are at their most vulnerable when the police are called, and to think that they're not being treated as such.
Five members of the class are over the age of 30. 17 of them have at least a bachelor's degree, including Jessica Gillette, who has a master's in peace and conflict studies. She says she considered the current tension between police and communities of color while she was going through the application process.
And so it really caused me to pause and reflect and say, is this something that I really want to do?
But she says her desire to see a shift in the profession motivated her to continue. She applied 3 times before she was finally accepted.
It's a trying and challenging time to get involved, but I think it's the most important time to get involved, especially if with someone who's coming from a peace studies and conflict studies background as a peace practitioner, because that's really what we advocate in this department. And, you know, we're guardians of the community. We're not warriors. We're protectors.
At the end of the first week, the class spent 2 days at the Bethel Horizons ropes course near Dodgeville.
Go! Next, ready. 1, 2, 3.
Go!
Go! 1.
The course was physically challenging. They rappelled off a cliff, jumped off a telephone pole, and climbed a rope ladder whose rungs were several feet apart. But to complete the challenges, the class had to work together and rely on each other. Recruit Ethan Pierick says by the end of the course, he felt he was part of a team.
I just feel, I guess, a lot more excited, less nervousness and more excitement for the academy and to go through it. And it's been great seeing the class bond and get together. Doing the ropes course, even just, you know, in class. So I feel like we're already pretty close as a class, and I'm looking forward to continuing that.
In the coming weeks, the class will dig into law, ethics, and cultural competence. We'll have more stories along the way. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
We continue the conversation now about police recruiting. Some departments in Wisconsin and around the country are reporting difficulties finding enough new recruits to fill their open positions.
Joining us now to talk more about police recruiting when law enforcement is being scrutinized on the national stage more than ever before is Jim Palmer, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. Jim, thanks for coming back to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me on, Judith.
So what is your sense around the country of the challenges in recruiting enough new police officers?
Well, both across the country and in Wisconsin, it seems anecdotally very clear when I speak to officers and chiefs and sheriffs across the state and across the country that they are having a much more difficult time getting applicants to simply apply for the job of being a law enforcement officer. And in some cases, I was speaking to a chief this morning who said that his the number of applicants in just in the last 3 years has declined by more than 40%. And that's extraordinarily troubling and should be alarming to a lot of people.
In earlier times, was there more a sense of there were way more people who wanted to be police officers than could even be accepted?
Absolutely. And that's been the case for many years that law enforcement was a very sought-after profession. Despite the fact that it is dangerous and does require a lot of training and education, but certainly we have that has changed, and it's changed in a way that is troubling.
And so, what has changed? It's still a demanding job, but it was a demanding and challenging job when there was a lot of competition to become a police officer.
Well, I think clearly this is the most challenging era ever to confront law enforcement officers in this country. And there are a number of reasons why. I mean, certainly there are disparities in this country that have worsened, whether it's due to truth in sentencing and some of our drug laws and enforcement laws. Obviously, a lot of those problems was not the cause of those. But also you have some interesting, dynamics in terms of how people interact with each other, the availability of information. I mean, when you think about the fact that, cell phones first, came on the scene in the United States in 2002, and by 2007, there were 2007 is when people could start, taking video. And, now you have over 300 million people in this country that use cell phones. I mean, that's incredible. You have over 270 million people who actively use Facebook each month. And they're using Facebook and Twitter, according to the Pew Research Center. More than 80% of the people use Facebook and Twitter for their news. And, you know, they see a news headline that they like. That's the story that they read, so they can pick and choose. There's more selectivity than there was ever before. That's changed how I think the media reports stories. I mean, now it's about, you know, getting that story first. And because if you're, you know, you're not first and somebody else is beating you to it, they have a competitive advantage, and they're going to have more viewers and readers and so forth. And so all these dynamics, I think, have come together to create a perfect storm that has really, I think, in some respects, conditioned a lot of people to think a certain way about law enforcement. And anytime they see the headline about a law enforcement officer's use of force, I mean, I think there is a growing skepticism about that, despite the fact that statistically it's really not supported. And I think that's important to note.
And so those are some of the external challenges. But looking critically within police departments, do you think there is also an element of perhaps police departments not responding to a changing landscape quickly enough to be able to make an attractive profession and to support those who are in the profession already?
I think clearly there, law enforcement generally does absolutely have some responsibility for the fact that the relationship that it has with the communities that it serves is not as strong as it should be. Ferguson was a good example in the sense that the diversity, the demographic makeup of that department was not representative of the community. And fortunately in Wisconsin it is better, and Madison, as you may well know, about 20% of the public, the city's population, is a racial or ethnic minority, and that's is about the same for the police department. And so, in many ways, Wisconsin's ahead of the curve, but nationally, that's absolutely true, and that has helped really, I think, promulgate some of these negative media narratives that we've seen become so prevalent.
We're talking to Jim Palmer right now. He's executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association, and we're discussing getting more recruits onto the police force, and that amid highly publicized tensions between communities and law enforcement.
And we want to hear from you. Do you work in law enforcement? Do you feel like the high-profile stories in the media have affected you, the way you do your job, the way you think about your job? Maybe you've considered joining a police force recently. Have recent events made you lean one way or the other when you make that decision? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Also, let us know if you're a community member who works with law enforcement. Let us know if you've seen or want to see changes in the way police officers are trained. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or again, post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our conversation with Jim Palmer, executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association, about police departments facing a shortage of recruits.
And we want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. Has the focus on law enforcement and national media changed your perception of the police and whether or not you would want to join the force? If you are already in law enforcement, tell us if you see training for police changing, if you think there are changes that need to be made, what your life is like after Ferguson, after a lot of the high-profile incidents we've seen. If you're a community member, talk to us about what you are thinking of the police in this difficult time between police departments and many communities around the country, what you like, what you would like to see change. Again, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
So, Jim, there were, again, some high-profile shootings in Charlotte, North Carolina, and also in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And you were recently part of a conference that met in the Wisconsin Dells to talk about how to handle an officer-involved shooting. And we are seeing some pretty different approaches, especially out of Tulsa, the police chief saying that he was really committed to, I believe he used the term, justice. And so what do you in your position recommend or suggest as resources for the police departments in Wisconsin?
Well, I was meeting with an association of training officers from across Wisconsin, and the idea or my goal was to really talk about, you know, what we've seen. Our organization represents more officers involved in these, you know, sensitive, critical situations than anyone else, and so we'd like to think we've, you know, garnered some experience and wisdom, hopefully, in all of that, and just to talk about what the officers have to think about and how they can, you know, look out for themselves and their own well-being, what the agencies can do, in order to look out for the officer. And also, you know, the idea is it was a very holistic presentation in the sense that we want to make sure we care for the officer, but we also want to facilitate the officer's voluntary cooperation with the investigation, because that really is fundamentally important. It has to be transparent. The investigation has to be credible. And if none of those things are present, then I think, you know, that's how the public's trust suffers. And that's not something we want. And we have a good relationship with, I think law enforcement has a very good relationship with the state overall. And I think it's because we do some things like that that are unique. Mm-hmm. And in other states, it's unusual, for example, for officers to voluntarily give a statement to, you know, criminal investigators of one of their shootings. And that's something that here in Wisconsin has become the regular course of business.
You have said in this interview and when we've spoken with you previously that the common occurrence of incidents being taped, say, on a cell phone, put up on social media, picked up by the media without as much context as maybe would be helpful, that can be very difficult for police officers and police departments. But do you see any positive aspect of that for the officers?
Well, I certainly hope so. I'm hoping that, you know, these situations, as controversial and as taxing as they are on so many people, including law enforcement officers, that we can really have a meaningful community-wide dialogue, not just in the city of Madison or mm-hmm. Wisconsin, but nationally, about the challenges that officers face. And also, I think it's important to talk about the challenges that minorities face in this country. We really have to have kind of a sentinel event type of review approach where we, you know, it's not in kind of a non-blaming forum, but it's let's identify the problems and what we can do to get our arms around them. And right now, we're really not doing that. We're talking about these kind of sensational events that are based on, you know, piecemeal information. And that's, I think, destructive to where we need to go in terms of that dialogue.
And we've been talking about the need to find more new recruits. Is that solely because there are fewer people applying, or are officers leaving the force in greater numbers and so there's more space to be filled?
I think it's a little both, frankly. I think officers who are eligible to retire, I think there are quite a few of them that are retiring, even though they, you know, probably had intended on working a little bit later in their lives. And I think, you know, the level of scrutiny that is being applied to law enforcement officers across the country is extraordinary. And you can understand, what kind of prospect that would, make for somebody, a young person, you know, trying to decide what they're going to do for the rest of their life.
Let's invite some of our listeners to join the conversation. We'll go first to Dennis in Toma. Hi, Dennis. Dennis, can you turn your radio down? And we'd be happy to hear from you.
I just did.
Okay, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Dennis, and I'm originally from Chicago. I've got cousins, I've got in-laws, all kinds of friends and family that are police and fire, and many of the ones that are older are taking early retirement, like you just said, but the other problem you run into down there is the education system for putting out people who could qualify for this test is woefully inadequate. Chicago regularly advertises to put people to take the tests for the fire academy and the police academy, and upwards of 10,000-12,000 people will sign up for the test. But between the physical, the background check, and the test itself, usually 75% to 80% of the people who originally sign up are already eliminated before they ever get to the actual point of going to class and starting the training.
And thanks for that call, and I want to give Jim Palmer a chance to respond to that.
I've heard that same narrative play out many times in Wisconsin as well. And, you know, here in Wisconsin, we've actually worked in conjunction with some other law enforcement groups, those that represent the chiefs and sheriffs, to actually elevate the training and certification standards. And because we want the best officers in the country, I believe Wisconsin has those. We're fortunate in that way. But it's true that I'm hearing time and time again that, you know, even those applicants that are entering the process, they don't make it very far and are often disqualified in the background check stage.
Thanks for that call. And let's go next to Nick in Greenfield. Hi, Nick.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. And I just wanted to say to this officer, the gentleman, two things. There was an officer one time who had the third shift, and one afternoon he rode through the neighborhood and he said, "I don't recognize the neighborhood." He says, "These are all different people. They're all nice and hardworking people. He says, not what I encounter at night with, at, you know, give me a hard time. That's part one. My point is that the officers should probably live in the community so that they know better what's going on. And the second thing that I wanted to say, and that has to do with, say, like the incident in North Carolina, in the training, if an officer's not sure whether the guy is reaching for his gun or his driver's license, and he's not coming at him, then don't go immediately to deadly force.
That's a great point, Nick, and I want to make sure Jim can respond to that. So that is a question that comes up sometimes. There are certain jurisdictions that do require officers to live within some boundary, others that do not. Do you see pros and cons to that as far as feeling more connected to the communities that they're policing?
I see both pros and cons. I mean, certainly the pro could be that the officer might feel better connected to that assigned area, and that would help him communicate with the people that live there, and certainly there would be benefits to that. On the other hand, you know, law enforcement officers do feel at risk when they're not working, in addition to feeling at risk when they are working. And there are times when law enforcement officers want to go home and simply be a father and be a mother and, to have some amount of anonymity that divorces them from their profession, especially when it is so highly scrutinized in this country. So it really is cut both ways. I know that the president's task force on 21st century policing explored this to an extent. I think it would be hard for officers, especially in areas that are lower income, high crime, and I think that would be they would be at greater risk, and that's something that we'll have to consider going forward.
Our caller also brought up the issue of not going so quickly to what ends up being deadly force in some of these very tragic situations for all involved. And we did hear in reporter Bridget Bowden's piece about de-escalation training. How does that fit into helping police officers have the skills and tools that I'm sure that they want to have as they're policing and encountering these very tense situations?
The de-escalation training is very prevalent in Wisconsin, is becoming more prevalent, fortunately, across the country. And it really does require officers to take in the totality of the circumstances and how to analyze them. And so that they don't make brash decisions. At the same time, there's a lot of research that shows that an officer's ability to react to an individual is slower. Even if an individual has, let's say, a gun at their side and their hands are all the way down, there's a lot of research that shows that individual can raise a gun and fire around before an officer can react, even if he's aiming at them. And that's that's science. And I think that's I really appreciate the question because it gives an opportunity for us to have that exchange. And I think we need to have more of it.
And Jim, as we get close to wrapping up, what are some of the approaches that Wisconsin police departments are taking to maybe reach out to people who would not normally see a career in law enforcement as a natural option for them?
Well, it's interesting. We see here in Madison, we've seen billboards, and there are a number of communities around the state and around the country that are actually using, active public relations campaigns, commercials, to make people feel good about the law enforcement profession, and to let anyone who might be interested in the profession know that agency welcomes diversity, and that they can make an important contribution to the safety of that community.
Well, Jim, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jim Palmer is Executive Director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. He joined us to talk about the falling number of police recruits amid increased scrutiny.